From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org, Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I'm recording this podcast on Monday morning, March 9th, 2020. I've chosen three articles to review with you today, one looking at mortality after drug-eluting stents versus coronary bypass graft surgery for left main disease. The second, a wonderful state-of-the-art review looking at diuretic use in patients with heart failure. And then lastly, a study which examines the use of cardiovascular magnetic resonance imaging in patients with checkpoint inhibitor-induced myocarditis. So let's get started with the meta-analysis of PCI versus CABG in left main disease. This was published this week in the European Heart Journal. And the authors put together all of the trials that they felt were most relevant to the question, what is the optimal method of revascularization for left main coronary disease? Five trials were in this study, including one published by Boudreaux in 2011, and the four other trials were called Pre-Combat, Noble, Excel, and Syntax. From the five trials, there were over 4,500 patients, of which half were randomized to PCI, the other half to drug-eluting stent in left main stenosis. The Boudreaux paper was a one-year follow-up. Five-year follow-up was available for Pre-Combat, Noble, Excel, and 10-year follow-up for the Syntax trial. So overall, the average weighted follow-up period was 67 months. At last follow-up, there was no significant difference in all-cause mortality between PCI and drug-eluting stent. There was also no significant difference in the risk of stroke or all MI. Patients undergoing PCI did have a higher rate of unplanned revascularization later. The hazard rate was about 1.7. So the authors concluded in this meta-analysis of randomized trials comparing PCI and coronary bypass graft surgery for left main that there was no significant difference in all-cause mortality, cardiac death, stroke, or MI with follow-up to 5 and 6 years. Unplanned revascularization was less common after CABG. Obviously, there are limitations to any meta-analysis. It's a small number of trials. There's varying outcomes in terms of time of follow-up, and longer-term follow-up might be needed to show if there was a significant difference between PCI and CABG. And of course, this study applies to patients who were randomizable. That is, their coronary disease in the main was felt to be amenable to PCI. Presumably, many of them, if not all, had a lower relative burden of disease elsewhere for whom multivessel CABG might be preferred. But within the context of what we currently know, this certainly is a study that supports both the findings of Noble and Excel, that is, that patients who are anatomically appropriate for PCI, and particularly for whom there's either a strong comorbid reason or patient preference to avoid coronary bypass graft surgery, that PCI represents a reasonable option as it relates to at least midterm outcomes, that is, out to 5 years. The next paper I want to talk to you about is a wonderful state-of-the-art review in JACC on the use of diuretic therapy in heart failure. And obviously, we all deal with this all the time, and it's such a big area, and there's unfortunately not a lot of clinical trial science to guide us. The authors point out that effective diuretic action for patients requires four steps: ingestion and gastrointestinal absorption of an oral agent, delivery to the kidney, secretion into the tubule lumen, and binding to the transprotein. When you initiate loop diuretics in hospitalized patients, the recommendation is that you increase their outpatient dose by 2.5-fold on a milligram per milligram basis. So if the patient was taking 40 milligrams of oral furosemide twice a day, you would give them 100 milligrams of furosemide IV twice a day to initiate treatment. For patients not receiving long-term loop diuretic agents, 40 to 80 milligrams IV twice a day of furosemide or an equivalent would be a reasonable starting dose. Clearly, subsequent doses of loop diuretic agents should be designed according to response. And typically, if a patient's going to respond to a dose, it's going to happen within 2 hours. And if it doesn't happen within 2 hours, you should go ahead and increase the dose appropriately. And there's a logarithmic substantial increase in effect as you go up in dose. We want to monitor renal function, of course, and a bump in the serum creatinine is typical when we initiate or accelerate IV diuresis. A bump in creatinine of up to 0.5 milligrams per deciliter is not uncommon at all and does not represent necessarily a reason for stopping or decreasing the dose. Obviously, this would pertain if persistent congestion is present. And these types of bumps are very common. The notion of diuretic resistance versus diuretic efficacy is very, very hard to define clinically. Qualitatively, obviously, we see diuretic resistance a lot, and this is an inadequate response of naturesis despite what appears to be an adequate diuretic regimen. And this, of course, is a huge challenge. For patients that are truly resistant, we have several options. One option would be to switch from twice-a-day IV dosing to a drip. Some patients appear to respond better to a drip versus twice-a-day IV diuresis. And oftentimes we'll add combination nephron blockade with a thiazide-like drug like metolazone. Or we can consider other strategies where we might add acetazolamide. That's part of the ongoing ADVOR trial. Or diuretic doses of mineralocorticoid antagonist like spironolactone. That's part of the Athena heart failure trial. Or low-dose dopamine, which is part of the ROSE AHF trial looking at HEF-REF. Clearly, withdrawal of diuretics is a good idea in patients with heart failure who no longer require them. It appears from all of the trial data that if you're able to get a patient off of loop diuretics, for instance, if the heart is reverse remodeling and the shape of the heart is improving and diuretic is no longer required, that's a good thing, and those patients tend to do better. So this is a nice review. I recommend it to you. I think we all deal with diuretic use in heart failure patients a lot, and I thought there was some very interesting and actionable knowledge points in that article. The last paper I want to mention is a study this week in European Heart Journal looking at the use of cardiac MR in patients with immune checkpoint inhibitor-associated myocarditis. You know, myocardial imaging with MR has become a darling of our field as we learn of its amazing ability to help us assess scar, inflammation, etc. And this particular article really looked at the question of how good is MR for identifying myocarditis in patients who receive checkpoint inhibitors, these new wonder drugs that we're seeing used in cancer. It's a study of 103 patients diagnosed with ICI-associated myocarditis. The patients had a mean EF of 50%. 61% of them had an EF greater than 50%. Late gadolinium enhancement was only present in 48% overall, and only 55% of the patients who had a reduced EF. If the EF was preserved, then the sensitivity was only 43%. Looking at T2-weighted short tau inversion recovery was present in 28% overall, and late gadolinium enhancement was rare. It was only up in 21.6%. in percent of patients if the CMR was performed within 4 days of admission, and 72% if the study was 4 days or after. Late gadolinium enhancement was present only in 35% of patients that had pathologic fibrosis, and the elevated T2-weighted STIR signal was present only in 26% who had lymphocytic infiltration on biopsy. 40% of the patients had follow-up over 5 months, and the presence of these various MR-related outcomes, late gadolinium enhancement, the pattern, or elevated T2-weighted imaging findings was not associated with MACE. I found this to be an important article because it certainly suggests that we cannot rely on the findings of MR to be either sensitive or specific in patients who have checkpoint inhibitor-related myocarditis. And if you use that technique and the study is negative, but your suspicion for the problem is still high, then you should probably consider going ahead with a biopsy to try to further clarify the cause of an acute cardiac ailment. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I enjoy bringing you two or three articles a week that I find interesting and potentially useful for my practice and hopefully yours. We talked about left main treatment, PCI versus CABG. We talked about diuretic therapy in hospitalized patients with heart failure. And lastly, a look at the use of cardiac MR in patients with suspected checkpoint inhibitor-related myocarditis. You can find the articles and also the journal scans on the website. Also, please visit the Education and Meetings tab on acc.org. Using that tool, you can find all kinds of educational offerings and formats that are available to you on the website. I hope you have a great week, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Thank you.